From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Introducing my guest today seems almost like an exercise in absurdity. If you don't know the name Steve Inskeep, welcome to public radio. This must be the first time you've listened, and we're so glad to have you with us. For 15 years, Steve Inskeep has anchored what is now the most listened to radio program in the United States, news radio program. Hosting NPR's Morning Edition requires a daily wake-up time of 2:45 a.m. Despite that, or perhaps because of it, he's written two books and expects to see his third published in early 2020. He also hosts the Morning News podcast, Up First, along with Rachel Martin, David Greene, and Noel King. He's known for his interviews with high-level political leaders, including an exit interview with President Barack Obama, and he's written for publications including The New York Times, Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. His collection of awards includes a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for The Price of African Oil and a National Headliner Award for investigating a military raid gone wrong in Afghanistan. He's twice been part of NPR news teams awarded the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Silver Baton for coverage of Iraq. He received that same award a third time for conversations on race with Michelle Norris, called The York Project. Steve Inskeep, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Coastline.
It's kind of embarrassing, actually, to have all of those things right in a row, but thank you. It's very flattering, and it's great to be here. Great to be talking with you, Rachel.
So this exit interview that you did with President Barack Obama, when Donald Trump was president-elect, at one point, President Obama criticized the absence of serious policy debate during the presidential campaigns. He criticized news organizations as well for their failure on that front, instead covering what he called the shiny objects.
Yeah.
And you asked whether that was the fault of the media or the result of the candidates just keeping their focus on the shiny objects. Of course, it sounded as though your implication was we can only report what they actually discuss. But he suggested that, no, you probably needed to do some self-examination. Have you? And what do you think about that now as we head into another presidential campaign season?
Well, I don't remember the exact wording of that exchange that you described, but it's a totally fair question to raise. And I think the answer is yes. I personally have thought a lot about how the media generally covered the campaign and also how we at NPR covered the campaign. The first thing that I want to say about it is that when people talk about or criticize the media using that phrase, I'm already a little skeptical of what they're talking about, because which media are you talking about? Which specific news organizations? Which stories are you concerned about?
And
are
he pretty much named all of them.
Sure.
And he specifically called out NPR.
Yeah, well, that's. I think that that is it's fair to raise the question. And I have a number of thoughts about that. First, I think it is true that when you have nominees for a major party and they are saying what they're saying, you cover what they're saying and you bring it to the public. And I don't think that that, as some people would say, is necessarily providing a megaphone for lies or whatever, even though candidates have been known to lie, haven't they? It's not, so long as, and I believe NPR does this, we tell you what they're saying, and we also give you sufficient facts and context so that you can make up your own mind about whether you buy this. And in a number of cases where we're able to verify this claim being made by the president or this claim being made by a presidential candidate is false, we say so. We flatly say so. There have been some dramatic examples of that during this administration, as I might add, the last administration, although this administration has a particular distinct approach to the truth. And I think of cases like the separation of families as they were arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border in the past year. The Trump administration openly announced they were going to do that. They were comfortable saying they were going to do that. They believed it would be a deterrent to people coming. There were multiple top officials like the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Chief of Staff at the White House who talked on the record, including on NPR, about this policy. And then when it became profoundly unpopular, the Secretary of Homeland Security at the time, Kirstjen Nielsen, said in public, in writing, there is no policy to separate children at the border. when obviously there was. Only in the most technical sense could she have claimed that was a true statement, and so we reported what she said as a false statement and said again and again that it was a false statement. So that's something that we did there. Now, getting more specifically to the question of the 2016 presidential campaign, I think NPR did all right. I don't think we did supremely well in every respect. I think we did all right in listening to voters, in exploring issues, in taking a serious look at things, in calling out falsehoods. And I think that people who were listening to NPR could get a reasonably good idea of the stakes of the election and also of what voters were thinking. I heard from some perceptive NPR listeners who said they were less surprised by the results of the election than some people might have been, because we spent time out in communities listening to voters, listening to what we like to call real people, as if people in Washington, people in Washington are also real people, to be honest with you. But, getting out and talking to voters, we had that. But with that said, and I feel like I've gone on filibustering a little bit, I want to say that while I was happy, by and large, with our coverage in 2016, I want to do better in 2020. I think that if we look more broadly across the media landscape, it was a hugely consequential election in which the discussion was not always that intelligent or not always focused on the most vital things. And now we're beginning this presidential campaign that is really interesting, where there's a ridiculous number of candidates and also a lot of ideas on the table. President Trump's ideas, which were frankly not as well developed. They were great slogans in 2016, but people weren't quite sure what he really wanted to do, how he intended to do it. Now we have a better idea of how he wants to govern because he's governed or tried to govern. And we have a better idea of what's really important to him and what is not so important to him and that he's let fall to the side. And so there are really distinct ideas of America and the world that we can argue about. And there's a bunch of Democrats who have put a bunch of different ideas of America and different specific policies on the table that we can argue about. And we've tried, in an unusually early date, to get into that serious policy debate. I'm just rambling on until you break in with another question.
This presidential campaign is going to be more about ideas and specific policy proposals.
Let me say that coverage that I have anything to do with will be intensively focused on ideas to the extent that we can manage it, to the extent that we can get away with it. I think that was true before. I think we can do a better job this time around, and that doesn't mean that there will be a different candidate winning. It could be that the president will win re-election. It's not my business to push the election one way or the other. I want, as a citizen, to make sure that my fellow citizens are well informed to make their own decision.
You also asked President Obama about whether the presidency had become too powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And he responded by separating his answer into domestic and foreign policy and talked about how sometimes with international threats, there's intelligence that's classified or there are other sensitive reasons that the White House wouldn't bring a question openly to Congress.
Yeah.
Yes. When you think about that answer today, does it affect the way you understand the escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, I'm glad that you raised that in the context of a different president than now, because now that President Trump is president and is doing what he's doing, there is enormous concern in an enormous part of this country about an overpowering president riding roughshod over the limitations that we imagine are there in the Constitution, that we believe are there in the Constitution. But it's good to remember that just 2 or 3 years ago, an entirely different huge swath of the country was concerned about a different president, also accused of overstepping his bounds and running roughshod over the limitations of the Constitution. I think regardless of who is president, we have learned that it is an enormously powerful position in which a lot of the limitations placed on the presidency are notional or customary, or as people have said, they're normal, they're norms.
And you're saying the power of that office has expanded just because of public expectation.
I'm a student of history, and it has expanded throughout the time of the United States. Periodically, there have been times that Congress has reasserted itself, but then the presidency grows again. The president has the power to act and act swiftly. The president, I mean, as there is, as we've, you know, we've been reminded in the last couple of years, the president of the United States can order a nuclear strike, can order the destruction of the planet. And if everybody follows his or her orders, it's done. It's done. And he doesn't have to check with anybody. That is an enormous power that, for various reasons, Congress has given to the president of the United States, partly because the Constitution says he's commander-in-chief, partly because we developed our nuclear arsenal throughout the Cold War when there was concern that there might need to be a decision made in minutes. And the president has that kind of huge power in enormous swaths of the government. We've also learned, of course, that there are laws and there are courts and there are systems and there are individuals who all push back. We've learned that the president, according to the Mueller report, told his own White House counsel to get rid of the special counsel, Robert Mueller. And the White House counsel said, no, I'm not going to do that. If I have to do that, I'm going to resign first. And the president apparently decided the cost was too high. He ranted about getting rid of Robert Mueller, but never actually fired Robert Mueller. We know that the president promised in his campaign to temporarily, for an undetermined time, could have been forever, we don't know, ban Muslims from entering the United States. He ultimately wasn't able to do that. He was able to do something that was much more limited under the law.
You're listening to Coastline. Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll find out how he handles what he calls a poorly written plot with way too many characters. That's what constitutes the daily news. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Steve Inskeep has hosted NPR's Morning Edition since 2004. He's won numerous awards for his journalism, and he's managed to pen three books, the latest due out early next year. He is in Wilmington today, and our conversation is pre-recorded. So let's go back to this. You did once describe the news as a poorly laid out plot. And I might be misquoting you slightly with too many characters.
Sure, like a giant miniseries, you know, like an ongoing series, like Game of Thrones or something like that. Only, you know, not as well plotted as Game of Thrones.
Is that really how you see it?
Well, I mean, I was joking, but in a way, I'm not. You have this big ongoing story of America. And that's what we're covering, really. And it's also the world, but it's America in the world. It's also other stories elsewhere that you want to have a sense of. And maybe because I do write history, I try to bring a sense of history to that. And I think about the particular traditions and the particular background of the stories that go back generations in many cases. And we follow certain characters over time. And there's someone like, I don't know, Donald Trump, just to name a person that just comes to mind. This is a guy who was making headlines in the 80s, and they were political headlines. I'm going to run for mayor. Maybe I'm going to run for president. I have particular ideas. I want the Central Park Five executed. I want this to happen. I want that to happen. I'm liberal. I'm conservative. I'm whatever. And then in the 90s, briefly ran for president and quickly withdrew. It didn't make sense for him then. Or I forget if it was 96 or 2000, but it was the late 90s anyway. And he then had this history of baiting and challenging the president of the United States about his birth certificate, and then burst on this. And it's this ongoing story. And there's a lot of other characters involved in that story, endless numbers of characters involved in that story who have decisions to make about, do they want to be for this guy? Do they want to be against this guy? There are all kinds of stories and policies and possibilities. It goes back a long time. If we just think about the president's policies on China, he's got this trade war. It's already, like many months old, but it's building on more than 200-year history of the United States trading with China in different ways, engaging with China in different ways, imagining we're going to change China in some way, feeling we need to change China in some way, trying to get a fair deal. I mean, these things go back generations, and we could do that about one story after another that's in the news. And I like to think of it that way. It is the opposite of over-focusing on the very latest burp of whatever just happened.
Right.
This is a dangerous thing for a news person to say. But very often, the very, very, very latest item of breaking news is not important at all.
Right.
And if you just wait a minute, like the seeming importance will dissipate, or wait a day or a week. Some of the latest breaking stories are super important. But the thing really to understand is like the sweep, the ongoing narrative. In the same way that, you know, whether you just stepped off the curb or not is probably not the most important part of your life, but I bet that all the moments of your life really add up to something.
And a couple hundred years later, your second book, Jackson Land, is sort of about, in the long view, in the rear view mirror, taking a look
yes.
at history. But let's not go there yet.
Okay. You go anywhere you want to go. It's totally fine.
So people talk about NPR's liberal bias, especially here in southeastern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Pew found NPR's Obama coverage more neutral instead of, I think, as you put it once, blazingly positive. And if you do listen carefully, it is hard to challenge the objectivity of a particular NPR reporter mm-hmm. on the particular facts of a story.
Yeah.
But I still consistently hear from conservative Republicans that perhaps we, WHQR, not producing biased local news, but NPR is absolutely left-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time during the coverage of the Trump administration not so long ago that it did seem that news magazine producers we're almost thinking, how can we bash Trump today? How can we hold up one of his foibles and talk to a longtime politico, some sort of policy analyst or expert who's been there for decades about why this is an irrational or impossible or just horrendous idea? And it makes me wonder, is there a built-in challenge that you have when you're dealing with an administration that isn't following any of the previous rules? How do you check yourself on that?
Oh, my goodness. I have so much to say to this. And you're just going to jump in and stop me if I'm going on too long. First, you are correct that when outside surveys have been done, they have found that NPR's coverage is far more neutral than other people's coverage. And that was a study specifically when Obama was president, like the first year of Obama's presidency. There were some media you could accuse of being super glowing about the president, but NPR was not one of those networks. NPR was described as one of those networks on Fox News, which repeats that over and over again, but Fox News was unable to back it up with facts. The facts are what we just said. The facts are what we found in the study. And so I think that anytime anybody's looked at NPR's coverage, they found that we work really hard to be fair, that we work really hard to be honest, that we work really hard to listen to different perspectives. I would not claim perfection, and we could drill in and talk about specific stories. But I want also to note that if we went to a different part of the country, and in fact, because there are liberals and conservatives all over America, there's probably somebody listening now, in fact, who has the totally opposite view of NPR. Why do you have conservatives on all the time on Morning Edition? Why, after that Alabama law was passed banning virtually all abortions the other day, did you have on Morning Edition someone who is pro-life talking about why they believe in that law, why they want to make it happen? Why did you hear from that voice? That is a question that we get. That is a question that I got via Twitter in my Twitter timeline. People talk to me on Twitter all the time, as you can imagine. That's a question I got on this very day that we're recording this very program. Why did you have a conservative on the air? Why do you talk to Jonah Goldberg of National Review all the time? Why do you talk to these people? And of course, the reason we talk to these people, if you want to put it that way, is because they're Americans with a point of view, and they may be right or they may be wrong, but their points of view are important and can be influential and affect lives, and I want to hear from everybody. And I am totally open to the idea that this or that story is just wrong, that we got the facts wrong, or what happens more often, I think, is all of our facts are right, but maybe there are more facts that we ought to bring in. But that needs to be a reality-based discussion. And the reality is, if you turn on the radio and listen to Morning Edition, just to give an example of the program that I'm most closely associated with, you're going to hear voices from the left, you're going to hear voices from the right. You're going to hear Democratic presidential candidates. You're going to hear a White House spokesman. You're going to hear all kinds of different people over time on the issues. And I want to say one thing more. It is hard in a politically polarized environment to judge that based on the interview that has just been on. Because if we just had an interview with somebody who has a perspective from the left or the right or up on the moon or whatever the perspective is, if you don't like that perspective, you may feel, I'm just really mad that's on the air. And why is that perspective on the air all the time? And maybe it's not on the air all the time. It's just what was just on. It's really hard to get a handle on that. Although when people like the Pew Center for Journalism take a look at it, they find what we described before.
Right. And it's interesting to me, too, that you just retweeted an opinion piece from the National Review about Alabama's...
David French, conservative writer. He's also a critic of President Trump, but he is an opponent of abortion and completely approves of the idea of Alabama passing this law and sending it up to the Supreme Court, even though everyone agrees that it is in contradiction to Roe versus Wade. I believe even the law itself contains language suggesting that it's probably an unenforceable law, but they're going to do it as a test case. And David French of the National Review believes that is an opportunity to do something that he thinks is morally right and also get that question before the court in a square way so the court can either do thumbs up or thumbs down.
And take it out of politics.
Yeah, although David French, we ended up having an exchange back and forth on Twitter. David is not pretending that this is going to take it out of politics, but he wants it to be out of politics in the way that it currently is, where for many Americans, it is on the national level, it is the sole issue, and they vote only on that, and people who don't believe as they do are disqualified, which means we can't have a full debate about the other 100 issues that we face.
One of my favorite things that you've ever said, you said to Nouveau magazine, this was, I think, in 2011, which is an Indiana alt-weekly publication, you said, "The most important thing I've learned as a journalist is that many of the things that seem obviously blindingly true today are not."
Yes, that's true.
You don't just arrive at NPR each morning unbiased with a clear mind. What kinds of self-inquiry do you engage in?
Wow. Well, I feel that I'm always learning and always keeping an open mind. And, you know, do I have political opinions? Do I have biases? I'm sure that I do. I vote. I don't talk about how I vote. As a journalist, I feel that the single most important trait is reflected in that quote that you kindly looked up and repeated. I should never totally make up my mind about anything. I should never ever get to the point where I think that is true and I never have to check on that again or think about it again, because the things that seem obviously true seem to be obviously true may not be. And I learned that as a younger reporter, covering plane crashes. And I remember there was one particular plane crash that took place. It was the Egypt Air plane crash, which was in 2000. A plane had gone down in the Atlantic, and there was a series of about 5 days. And there are investigators out there, and they're like going down and getting the black boxes and doing all the things they do after a plane crash. And the National Transportation Board would have a daily press conference, and they would also talk in other ways with those of us who are reporters who cover them regularly. And so you're learning a little more every day. And each day there was some new fact that when added to the other facts, totally changed what seemed to have happened to this plane. Like 4 days in a row, there was an apparent cause of the crash that the next day we'd learn one more fact, and it was just obviously not that cause. And finally, at the very end, the safety investigators stopped telling us anything. And eventually we learned that the pilot appeared to have committed suicide by pushing the plane down into the water, which was a politically awkward thing to say because it was an Egyptian plane and it was seen as representing a Muslim society where suicide was even more frowned upon than it would be here, and just that it would be diplomatically bad to admit that the pilot seemed to have committed suicide. And so they just stopped talking about it. Yeah. And didn't openly admit the facts until a year or two later after 9/11. And so there was a story. My point is, it was a story that changed every single day. And what seemed so obviously true changed. And I think that's an important thing for me as a journalist to know. It's an important thing for citizens to think about. It's an important thing when you're looking at your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed or whatever. People show you videos and you think, oh, I saw that with my own eyes. It was on video. And it turns out to be, you know, bogus.
The sexual harassment investigation at NPR came out of allegations that former news executive Mike Oreskes had a history of inappropriate behavior before he was even hired by NPR, and that it was basically ignored. And he's gone now, of course, and there's a committee, I think, assigned to address the issue for NPR. And recently, Sarah McGammon tweeted about anti-harassment training juxtaposed against the most restrictive abortion law passed in Alabama. Mm-hmm. But talking about that training for NPR, so this is about a year and a half later. What is different in NPR's culture, and what have you learned in the training?
Let me think about that. There's first a point I want to make about Sarah McCammon specifically, because you were just talking about bias. I just want to note that my colleagues at NPR think about who we are and what our backgrounds are and where we come from. And we think about diversity. And you need to think about diversity in a lot of different ways in order to get it right or to get it better. When we say diversity, we think, well, there need to be more African Americans, and which is true in a great many organizations and arguably true in ours. But you also want like political diversity, diversity of background. Sarah McCammon is someone who's been fairly open about growing up in a very conservative Christian household in the middle of America. And that is a background that we want. And I don't need to know her exact religious affiliation as of this moment or anything like that. But it's really great to have someone around who is really deeply steeped in a particular religious tradition. And I grew up in Indiana, which is a very conservative state. And that gave me a particular view on the world that I take with me. And again, that's not saying anything about what my politics are at this minute or what my view of any issue is, but I want to have different backgrounds. Sarah is a super cool reporter and a great reporter. And she did make that remark about the sexual harassment training. I don't know exactly what it was she was required to be doing at that minute, but NPR has focused on this a lot. And I think there was some kind of committee that looked into this, but it's a thing that has been taken on by the whole of management in a really broad way and has touched on a lot of different issues that go beyond the immediate question of Mike Oreskes, this senior executive who had been found to have committed sexual harassment in a couple of different instances and then was revealed to have had a history of it at the New York Times.
Right. Which people at NPR knew about.
Some people at NPR did know about. And that was bad enough. But NPR's self-examination has gone well beyond that one person or that particular string of cases, and even beyond questions of sexual harassment. They have asked questions like, are men and women paid equally for the same work? And
are they?
An outside study was commissioned. I think this is public. The outside study found that, generally speaking, NPR employees are. It's a really complicated question because people bring different skills to different jobs and different levels of experience and so forth. But they applied whatever formula they did and found it was pretty good. Now, it didn't cover every single job at NPR. And I will tell you that there are some people within NPR who are not so sure that that is true in every single job that we can talk about. But this is something that we're examining, we're focusing on. And I rather like that they called somebody from the outside to study a big set of facts because then you're dealing with realities rather than perceptions. There are questions about the way that temporary versus permanent workers are treated at NPR. This did make news headlines a number of months ago. NPR traditionally has had a lot of people on staff who have temporary appointments. There are reasons, of course, that any organization would hire people as temps instead of permanent people, but that's very frustrating. It's hard for people to manage their lives. The temps in many, not all cases, but in many cases are very young, and so they feel very vulnerable, which can create a climate where maybe they can't speak out against harassment. It becomes connected to the headline issue of sexual harassment.
And you personally are a member of a class that traditionally hasn't had to think about this very mm-hmm. much. Have you learned anything?
Oh my gosh, I think that I have, and I think that I am fortunate in that I have worked for many years in an organization where I don't think that women would say that they've always been treated fairly, but where women have had a large voice, let's put it there that way, where there are people like Susan Stamberg and Nina Totenberg and Linda Wertheimer who are regarded as founding mothers of the organization, who've been around since the beginning or at least since the very early years. Cokie Roberts is another. I mean, people who have a large voice in the organization. I am fortunate at Morning Edition, there have been, in those 15 years that I've done it, there have been 5 executive producers. Every single one of them was a woman. A couple were women of color. There has been a lot of diversity in very important ranks within the organization. And women have promoted me and brought me forward and taught me a lot and mentored me. I've tried to be conscious of that and to return the favor when I can.
You're listening to Coastline. NPR's Steve Inskeep is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll try to squeeze 8 more hours of material into about 17 minutes. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Steve Inskeep, NPR's Morning Edition host, along with Rachel Martin, Noel King, and David Green, has won a passel of journalism awards. He's written 3 books, interviewed political leaders at the highest levels, and is in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is why he's our guest today. This conversation is pre-recorded. Your book, Jackson Land, published in 2015, is about the power struggle between Andrew Jackson and John Ross, who was the leader, essentially, of the Cherokee mm-hmm. Nation. And you describe this as the time when modern American democracy started to take shape. And you pose this question, how do we create and recreate a country that respects everybody's rights and still holds together as one country? Have we gotten too large to do that?
Oh, I don't think we've gotten too large to do that, but it gets really hard, doesn't it? And it was hard in the time that I chronicled in this book. And of course, it's not my insight that American democracy was taking shape at that time. Many people have observed that, and that Andrew Jackson was an important figure who rose to prominence just as the right to vote was expanding to include nearly all white men. It had been like a much more limited set of people before. And when the news media were growing and things were happening that allowed the country to take something more like the shape that we have now. What I feel that I did discover that was much less well known was the role of the Cherokee Nation in fighting for its rights within the democratic system before being evicted from a number of southern states, including North Carolina. And I say evicted with a little asterisk because, of course, a few Cherokees managed to stay in the mountains and are still there, and there is a Cherokee, North Carolina, which is named
you visited
that
Cherokee
for a reason. Yeah, a couple. I did some of my research there because there is a museum of the Cherokee Indian, and they have some archives. And I went back to talk about the book, which was a great experience, and it's just as this whole state is, just unbelievably beautiful.
And you have this fantastic photograph of Jackson entering Jackson County.
Yes.
Which is where Cherokee is located.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah. Well, I think it's Cherokee County, but there's Jackson County right there. Yeah, if I'm not screwing this up. Am I screwing up the let's not talk about geography. There's a Jackson County out there in any case. Yes. And there's like a sign that's so many miles to Cherokee. And there are Jackson counties all over the place. Anyway, the country was diverse then. It was not diverse in who got to vote because it was all kinds of white men who got to vote, and that was more diverse than it had been, but not very diverse. But the country had all kinds of people who labored, who created things, who also fought for their rights, who participated in whatever way they could in the democratic system. I discovered I hadn't known that even as Indians were fighting for their rights within our emerging democratic system, there were women who sympathized with their cause. And even though women could not vote and weren't supposed to participate in politics, they organized this petition campaign across the country. They made their voices heard and appeared in newspapers and so forth.
And you also
talked
about
an incredibly diverse time.
How the Cherokee people changed and adapted their own culture to be more white.
Yeah, this is one of the most poignant things that stuck in my head when I first learned about the policy of Indian removal, as it was called, the Trail of Tears and so forth in the early 1800s, that the Cherokees, taking an offer that went back to President Washington, adapted to what you could think of as white civilization or European civilization or whatever you want to call it. I mean, they changed their clothing. They changed their method of agriculture. They changed the houses that they lived in. And they were indistinguishable in a great many ways, or at least their elites were, from white Southerners. Now, there were more traditional Cherokees who dressed in more traditional ways and so forth.
Was that a form of self-preservation?
It was absolutely a form of self-preservation. They were wanting to adapt to this new country that was coming toward them. I came to think of the Cherokees like immigrants to a new country, except that instead of going to the new country had come to them. The United States was expanding from the coast inland and surrounding them, and they wanted a place in it. And John Ross, who was of both Cherokee and Scottish descent, had ideas that the Cherokee Nation in North Georgia and North Carolina and some other states, Tennessee, Alabama, a bit of South Carolina, although they sold that, that he had an idea that their land could become a territory and eventually a state. That was not destined to be. But they were wanting to find a way that they fit in to this new dynamic country that was growing up all around them.
Your third book, Imperfect Union, which comes out January of 2020.
Yeah.
You've described it as something of a follow-up to Jackson Land.
In some ways it is, because it's also about America's westward expansion. It's about the Western explorer John Charles Fremont, who was unbelievably famous in the 1800s. There was a magazine that said that John C. Fremont was one of the world's three most important world historical figures since Jesus Christ. Christopher Columbus, who brought Europeans to America, George Washington, who founded America, and John C. Fremont, who was a major figure in the conquest of California by the United States and was a big explorer and everything else. I also want to note that it's the story of two different kinds of unions. The Union, the American Union, that was coming apart while he was doing this exploring in the 1840s and 50s, and his union with his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont. John C. Fremont, as an explorer, didn't actually discover that much that was new, but he went home and wrote best-selling books about his adventures. And his wife, Jessie, was his editor, secretary, sometimes ghostwriter, co-author, political advisor, closest confidant, and a huge part of his story. And she ultimately became just about as famous as he was. And when he finally ran for president in 1856, it was almost as if a husband and wife were running for president.
This was a Facebook post of yours last July, not quite a year ago. You were finishing up this book, Imperfect Union, and you were away from Morning Edition, I guess, to finish that.
Yeah.
And you said it's hard, hard, hard to turn away from the news. How do you feel now? You're sitting in this studio. This conversation is pre-recorded. Probably at this exact moment, President Donald Trump is giving a speech about his new immigration policy, which we hear focuses on reducing family-based immigration to a turn towards skill-based employment, skill-based immigration. Is this hard for you?
I'm learning. It is hard on one level because I'm really interested in the news and I want to be on top of things. But my study of history in particular informs that. Like, you know, so President Trump is really focused on the southern border. This book that I'm just describing to you is about how we got that particular southern border, the conquest of California along with Arizona and New Mexico, what is now Arizona, New Mexico, some other states. It's about that. And it's you realize when you study the history, part of what happened and part of why this is so hard. We would like to think of the United States and Latin America as separate places. But when you look at the history, it becomes apparent that what happened in the 1840s was that the United States took over part of Latin America, which, put another way, in a more friendly way, we became part of Latin America. And there were people who came along with the land who are now American, and their descendants are American, and they're part of American culture, and they have brought the language, and they have brought the food, and they have brought ideas, and they have brought debate. And that debate is evident when I do the historical study going back to the 1840s and 50s. There's a lot. There's like an anti-immigrant movement that's rising in the United States in the 1840s and 50s. And there are questions about what we want to do with all of these Mexicans who are now part of the United States. And there were already Chinese people coming across to California at a very early date, remarkably so, and questions about how they should be handled and whether they should be treated equally or not. When the gold rush came, should they be allowed to mine gold in the same way? All these different things were happening then. And so it gives me a different perspective on what's happening now. And I would like to think that I draw energy off of studying the two of them at the same time.
And you present like a teacher. It's really interesting.
I don't know if you like school or not.
Okay. I feel like I'm learning all the time.
No, thank you.
It's true. And you had parents who were teachers.
And if I'm presenting like a teacher in a good way, it's because of them. I learned so much from them.
You also were adopted.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that? Do you know who your birth parents are?
I don't. I was adopted when I was 10 days old. And it was, you know, a couple years ago. So it was back in the era of closed adoptions, when it was thought that it was the best for all concerned if the parents never found out anything about what happened to their kid, and the kid never found out anything about their original family, and you just pretended that their adoptive family was the birth family.
Does that mean that now that we're out of that era, you can't go back and find out?
Indiana has actually changed its law where certain things are possible. But I do not at this time know anything that I want to share here. I've got a couple of stray facts, but I don't know very much.
Are you going to try to add to that list?
Well, I mean, I've actually asked the state of Indiana. There's a form that you fill out. And I felt, not so much for myself, but for my adopted daughter, it was suggested to me that if I could learn my own story, it might in some way help her, because she does not know her story. So I've asked to learn what I can. And one of these months or years, I may learn something or I may not.
How did your parents talk to you about it? And when did you find out?
At a very young age. I don't remember exactly what age. But there was very little for them to tell me, for the reason that I said. I grew up as their son.
Do you remember the moment that you learned?
I don't really, except that I remember being very young and knowing it. So I might have been 3, 4, 5, whenever they would have told me. Basically, they brought me up always knowing it. I have since learned occasional stories, and probably somebody listening has heard this kind of story or even experienced this kind of story where people aren't told at all, and they find out when they're 42 that their mom is not their mom, or not their biological mom. Let's be clear on that. And that was not the case in my family. My parents were open about what little they knew.
So you also understood then from a very young age that they didn't know very much.
Yeah, that's true. And I, you know, some people who are adopted have a really hard time with that information and struggle with it in different ways. I never did consciously. I don't know that it particularly affected my life or my thinking or my viewpoints. But the key in that phrase is I don't know. I mean, you never know how psychologically one thing might affect you one way or another.
What is the story of your daughter's adoption?
Oh, well, we adopted from China. And we had a daughter, and we wanted another, and we tried for a while, as people do, and didn't have another, and decided that we were comfortable adopting.
She was left in an elevator?
Yes, which is normal. In China, I mean, as people probably know, there are tens of thousands of Chinese babies or children who've been adopted into the United States, and some have been adopted elsewhere in the world. But as best we could learn the law, China had this one-child policy, which generally—
Which has since been relaxed.
It's been relaxed, but it's—yeah, exactly. But it's a different time now. But it did have this one-child policy, and you weren't supposed to have another kid. You also weren't supposed to be having another kid and giving the kid up for adoption. There just wasn't a system. And so the thing that had to happen was the child would be abandoned somewhere. That's what we're told. And our daughter, it's a common case. And I've written about this publicly, so I'm willing to say this much about it. But she was left and went into an orphanage and lived there until she was a little more than 3.5 years old, and then we were matched up with her. And she's amazing.
And what was the first thing she said to you when she met you?
Oh, my gosh. You're going to make me cry. Because we knew for a few months in advance that we'd been matched with her, and we sent her a little book of pictures of her new family. And we saw her in this Chinese government office in Wuhan, China, and she recognized me and walked over and said, Baba, which is the Chinese word for daddy, and kissed me on the cheek.
Oh.
And yeah, exactly. And she's an amazing kid and is doing really well in school and is 10 years old now. And it's a half English, half Chinese school. So she speaks and writes a lot of Chinese. And
are your other daughters learning Chinese?
As a matter of fact, they are. Yes.
Your biological daughters,
yes,
I should say.
Yes, she's got an older sister and a younger sister. And the younger sister is in the same school. And comes home singing songs in Chinese. And the older sister is in a different school for various reasons, but has been studying Chinese there. And so they can have some conversations in Chinese. It's pretty great.
You had a lot to say about Richard Lugar, who passed away.
My home state senator.
Senator from Indiana for 36 years, very well-respected Republican leader, also very influential on foreign policy and nuclear disarmament.
Yeah.
And the Associated Press actually credits his willingness to work with Democrats as the reason he lost re-election in 2012. I don't know if it's that simple. But you tweeted that you attended his funeral not as a journalist but as a Hoosier.
Yeah. I got unexpectedly I was invited to go, and I decided to go that way. There was a balcony full of reporters. I could have maybe just gone as a reporter. But I wanted to go as a citizen alone. Reporters are citizens, too. But, I mean, I wanted to go in that capacity. When Lugar – oh, we're running out of time.
Yeah.
So I'll just say very briefly, he's a guy that I'd always admired and who did work across the aisle and did a lot of things that are boring to talk about but affected millions and millions of lives. And it was great to hear about that at his funeral.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Steve Inskeep, what a pleasure having you with us. Thank you.
It went fast. Thank you so much.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org at the podcast. Find it on the HQR app or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.